Okay, we are back in session after our break. And before we go into executive, into the executive committee, I wanted to recognize Dr. Thrasher, the new head of the school board.
It is an absolute honor. Not something that I ever saw in my future, but I'm just really completely honored that I can't wait to work with everybody in this room as we continue moving things forward and growing that center for financial success and all of that.
We look forward to it as well.
Thank you.
Okay, so in the executive committee, we have one action item, which is the approval of honorific naming of a chairman at Gary Randolph Hall. And Dr. Corinne Murphy is going to speak to that. Mr. Page.
So, good morning, everyone. There's a weird moment in time that I'm going to take some liberty and share with you right now. This portrait showed up in my office randomly 2 weeks ago. And this is actually Tate Page. And so for those of you who thought Tate Page was a building, it turns out that, in fact, Tate Page was a person. The most random part about this was that simultaneous to this randomly showing up in my office, Amanda Trevue and her team, Philanthropy Alumni Engagement, have been helping us with the background research for the honorific naming of the terrorists at Gary Rensselaer Hall in honor of Tate Page. And so it's these weird moments in time where things just come together. And so it turns out that Dr. Gover, who is a longtime internal medicine physician here in Bowling Green and a WKU alum, had the portrait of Tate Page. And he handed it to his patient, Dr. Wes Cottingham, who is one of our WKU faculty, but also a WKU alum, and said, "You should go forth and do something with this." And so he dropped it off in my office. And simultaneous, Amanda and I had been emailing and reviewing the information for today's honorific naming. So weird circumstance of coincidence, but thought you all might be interested in how things come to be and just how closely knit our community really is in Bowling Green. And so with that being said, we are pleased to share with you today and seek your approval for the honorary naming of Tate C. Page Terrace, located in the front of Gary Rensselaer Hall in recognition of his service as a faculty member, department head, and dean at WKU. That terrace overlooks the former site of Tate Page Hall. And so Tate C. Page served as the dean of the College of Education at WKU from 1965 to 1973. He joined the faculty of Western Kentucky State College, now WKU, in September 1956 as a professor of education. He later went on to be the head of the Department of Education in 1959, and then as the dean of the College of Education in 1965, a position from which he retired in August 1973, and he and his wife Wanda moved to Russellville, Arkansas. Later, he died May 19, 1984. He's the son of William Page and Margaret Tate Page and was born in Muskegee, Oklahoma on January 6, 1908. He received his education at Arkansas Polytechnic College, received a bachelor's degree from Tulane University, a master's degree from the University of Kentucky, and a doctoral degree from the University of Kansas. He served in various positions as a teacher, principal, a superintendent, a football coach, including serving as the football coach for Atkins High School in Arkansas, Transylvania University here in Kentucky, and also Tulane University. And then he went on to be, well, Todd, the athletic director at Alabama Polytechnic Institute, now known as Auburn University, and Central Missouri State College. And so the former building housing the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences was raised in 2021, but it was named in his honor in 1988. And so this honorary naming request is recommended in recognition of the outstanding service of Dean Tate Page and his impact on the College of Education and Behavioral Sciences at WKU. The college will manage the cost of the plaque, and we will move the newly acquired portrait towards the terrace in some appropriate location, and this comes at the recommendation of President Cabot.
Dean Murphy, was that photograph slash painting somehow acquired from Tate Page Hall before it was taken down?
I cannot answer that question. Not because I am implicated
I'm
in any way.
I'm just curious if someone absconded with it or if there was a strategy.
There was not. But I mean, I do think that it's very apropos. We are, the shades are closed, but we know that we'll be raising the last beam shortly on Gordon Ford's new building. And it's exciting because it's also the home of previous education eras past. And so the terrace overlooks that space. And so I think it'll be, it's a nice way to honor someone who clearly has impacted education in a number of ways. And if you want a break from Tate Page, we still have some over in Gary Russell Hall. So if you do want some relics, we can get
President
you a break.
President Boney, Dr. Gover's a friend and a colleague of mine. I'll find out the answer to that. Maybe we'll give him a break.
We might be able to do so. So it's on my list to find him and say thank you.
So. Do we have any other questions or comments? Then I will ask for a motion for approval of the honorific naming of the terrace at Gary Ransdell Hall to the Tate C. Page Terrace.
So moved.
So moved.
Okay. Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right, thank you. The motion passes. And that was the only action item. We have an information item from Jennifer Smith on a legislative update.
I have my computer in case you have real specific questions about any of this legislation. I've got every bill pulled up that I'm going to talk to you all about. So in case there's anything that I don't have in my notes that you will need. Okay. So today is day 43, I think, of the legislative session. So this is the long session, 60 days. This has been the priority thing for the General Assembly to do is to pass the two-year budget. So I was going to start out with that. So House Bill 6 is the executive branch budget. Right now, it has passed the House. It is over in the Senate. We are awaiting Senate changes. But I thought I would just go ahead and explain what all is in the House version right now so that you all have an idea of at least where we're at. Okay, so as far as the operating budget is concerned, there's a 3% increase to our base appropriation in the first year of the biennium. The second year, they just kept that funding flat. So there was not an increase in the second year, an additional increase in the second year. Our Gatton funding remained unchanged. The funding for the Kentucky Mezzanet remained unchanged. They gave us about a little over $1.5 million for our KERS pension subsidy. And that is in each year of the budget. And then we received a lovely, I'm sure Susan loved this, when we found out that our fire and tornado insurance was going up a significant amount. So the House did include funding in each year of the budget of a little over $2.1 million in each year to cover that increase in that state fire and tornado insurance premium. And so that is what's in there for operating. For the capital side, there is another round of asset preservation funding. It's $28.5 million in each year for the comprehensive universe. Well, I mean, for us. For the comprehensive universities, there's no match. So the last budget, the 22-24 budget, there was a match in there where we had to 15%, I think, right? A 15% match that we had to come up with each comprehensive university. So, fingers crossed that no match stays where it is. And then the final thing, which I know Dean Bosta is super excited about, is that the House budget provides $160 million to build a new academic complex building. So, I told the president, I said, so I've been doing this. This is my 16th legislative session. I've been here for 15 years. And I said, about every 10 years, it seems like we got a building, so don't get your hopes up. And so when we received the funding for the College of Business last year, I was very surprised and very excited to get to share the news with him that that the House put that funding in there. So we just hope that the Senate keeps it in there as well. So like I said, it has passed the House. It is over in the Senate. The president has been to Frankfort probably more this year. I've dragged him up there more than probably every other year. I've made him come up there with me. But we had some great meetings with the Senate to talk about our needs for the budget and our capital. And I feel confident in what we're going to see come out of the Senate. I expect to see a Senate version of the budget within the next week or two. And then conference will happen, and they'll want to have the budget passed before the veto period, you know, the 10-day veto period, so that if there are any line item vetoes by the governor, they can come back and possibly override those if they feel they need to do that. Any questions on the budget? I'm going to read through this real quick. Okay. So the next two bills are, I'm kind of going to talk about these together because I think it's easier. They sort of go hand in hand. House Bill 9 and Senate Bill 6. I'm sure a lot of you all have heard about this. These are what are being referred to as anti-DEI bills, so diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 6 mainly because it's the one that has actually moved. So what it does is it defines discriminatory concepts over two pages, and it prohibits the universities from requiring students and employees and applicants for both admission and employment from endorsing a discriminatory concept of any sort. It also requires the universities to include a discussion and resources on the First Amendment at any new student orientation. And that includes we have to have the materials that we might hand out to students. Like, if I think we have to actually give them a copy of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. So that also has to be posted on our website in a prominent, easy-to-find location. And anything beyond that, so if we give them a one-pager on the First Amendment, that has to be up there too. So anything that we possibly give them has to be where anyone can come and see it on our website. It also requires, I'm getting ahead of myself here on the next page. Okay, so then it requires any employee, any DEI employee, and I'm using that kind of as a loose term because that's sort of how it's defined in the bill, but that their duties and shall include efforts to strengthen and increase intellectual disabilities among students and faculty, and to spend 50% of their time mentoring and coaching Pell-eligible students on our campuses. This is for all the public universities. It does say that it shall not infringe on free speech or academic freedom. So I've received a lot of questions about that and about the classes, the courses that we have, the classes that we give, and my comment is always, well, I'm not an attorney. And I explain, you know, we're very early into this process, and so until we know what a final bill that is passed looks like, it will really be up to, you know, our attorneys and those people to give guidance to the university on exactly what this will do and the all the different rules and guidelines that we'll have to follow. But it has passed the Senate. What passed out of the Senate was slightly different than what was filed. There was a committee substitute on the bill in the committee hearing, and that's what I just went over, was the committee substitute. But it has been received in the House, but it has not been referred to the committee yet. So the way the process works is anytime a bill comes over, it gets received, and then it usually goes to, well, it has to go to the Committee on Committees first, where it then gets assigned to a committee to actually receive a hearing, if they want it to receive a hearing. And so right now it's just been received in the House. And that was 2 weeks ago, I think. So that is Senate Bill 6. So then House Bill 9 really does all the same things as Senate Bill 6. but it goes much further in all of the prohibitions of programs and services and classes and everything that we can provide on campus. And I always have the hardest time talking about House Bill 9 because there's so much in it. We could probably still be here tomorrow if I were to go into a lot of detail on everything that's in there. But it has been referred to the House Education Committee, but it has not received a hearing yet. And it has not even been posted in the committee to be able to receive a hearing. So I really don't know what they're going to do as far as these two bills go. I don't know if we're going to see something that kind of brings the two bills together and has different pieces for each one in there. I don't know. And there's really not a whole lot of discussion going on right now about these two bills that I am hearing. So, do y'all have questions on either one of those? All right, so the next one, I'm going to run through this one really quick because it isn't going anywhere right now, but it affects our board. And so this is House Bill 228. And it requires the board of each public university to approve a performance and productivity evaluation process for all faculty members. It requires faculty evaluations to be completed at least every 4 years. That does not mean that it's every 4 years. That means you can do it yearly if you want to. You can do it biannually if you want to. But it has to be done at least within 4 years. And then it permits the board to delegate appointment and removal of faculty to the president. So this bill was actually heard in committee for in the House Education Committee for discussion only earlier. It was in January, but it has not been heard for an actual vote in committee yet. So right now there's just been no further action taken on that. So again, I'm not real sure where that's going to go, if they're going to end up passing that one or not. But if they do, I mean, that will be something that, you know, you all will be having to approve some sort of a evaluation process. So, okay, so then these next three things kind of all go together. So we've got House Bill 630. If you all were watching the news or listening, keeping an eye on anything yesterday, House Bill 630 permits WKU to offer up to 5 PhD programs related to workforce and economic needs of Kentucky. So to give you a little bit of background, there was a question, President Cavone actually testified in committee, and I'm going to turn it over to him in just a second to give you an update on that. But there was a question as, well, why can't comprehensive universities already do this? And I was the only person in the room who could actually answer that question because I was like, well, it's been there long enough to know why. So in 2011, there was a bill passed, some of you may have been here, that we had a group of physical therapists come to us and say, we really need a physical therapy program, an additional one in this part of the state. Well, back then, physical therapy is considered an advanced practice doctorate. So back then, we had to have a piece of legislation filed for each advanced practice doctorate program that a comprehensive university wanted to have. So that's how we got the EDD and the DNP. Those both could be used at every single university. So this was a special piece of legislation that we were going to be asking for that only went toward WKU. So what happened was through that process, that bill changed and it created the statute that allows all the comprehensive universities to have advanced practice doctorates. In 2011, there was a cap on that. It was like, I think it was a cap of 3, and then there were so many at-large advanced practice doctorates we could apply for through CPE. But that's how we got the Doctor of Physical Therapy. That's also how we got our PsyD. And so then in 2017, we came back and we amended that statute all of the comprehensive universities, amended that statute to lift the cap. And so now there's no longer a cap on how many of those types of programs we can have. It just has to go through the CPE processes like every other degree program that we have. So what this bill does, so but part of that bill in 2011 said that the comprehensive universities cannot offer, and it's kind of this laundry list of things that we're not allowed to do. And so one of those is PhDs, vet school, dental school, medical school, architecture, I think. I mean, there's like all kind. There's a list of things in there that we're not allowed to do. And so what House Bill 630 does is it amends that section of that statute that says WKU can offer these PhD programs. And so, because in case some of you are wondering, why in the world do we have to have a bill that allows us to do that? That's kind of the history behind that. So do you want to talk a little bit about your testimony?
So this has been very well received. It passed out of the House unanimously, and some folks are asking, well, why in the world do we need PhD programs at WKU? And this is a process, not just a moment in time, so this is the beginning of a conversation. But if you look at what we've built as an institution, as much as my sister institution presidents like to say we're all the same, the reality is WKU is not like the other comprehensive institutions in the state. Our annual federal research dollars and annual research expenditures are double that of the nearest other comprehensive institution, and most of them are vastly lower than we are. We've created the infrastructure. We've created an innovation campus, which for our region is going to really be the Transpark 2.0 to drive our economy. And we know that the Kearney classifications, we have two R1, Research 1 universities in the Commonwealth, Louisville, Kentucky. We do not aspire to be them. But we are the only state in our region. Every other state around us has a Research 2 university in it. The goal is not necessarily to become a Research 2 university. Our goal, which we announced at Convocation, is to double our research dollars in the next 5 to 7 years and our research expenditures. What offering 5 targeted PhD programs connected to the regional economy, what we're doing at the Innovation Center, allows us to do this. It changes the kind of faculty that we can recruit. It changes that we can have PhD students. Most importantly, it creates opportunities to attract and double our federal research funding and beyond. And so these are not PhDs in history or English. Those are wonderful PhDs, but that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about are things like data sciences, computational sciences, atmospheric sciences, and disaster sciences. Things that directly connect to our economy, will connect to the work that's being done at the Innovation Campus and the companies that are co-locating there, and where we know there are deep pockets of federal dollars available for investment. Neurosciences is one that I left off the list. This is a change. It's a complete departure. But what this does, it will amp up our research dollars, and eventually we'll become a Research 2 university. I mean, it's not something that anyone in the state decides. It's not something that we decide. We get a set of benchmarks, and it happens. But the reality is we're already different from the other comprehensives. Doing this and talking about it in a way that elevates us really puts us where we're supposed to be in the grand scheme of post-secondary education in the Commonwealth. You have 2 research universities. You have us, and then you have everybody else. We need to own that market position. It changes the conversation that we can have with prospective students and alters our ability to pursue federal investment. And the House and the Senate, both very excited about how we're going to drive the regional economy. Also, this is not a WKU thing. This is done in conjunction with and the support of the city, the county, the Economic Development Organization for the region, in the chamber. So we're all rowing in the same direction, thinking about what comes next for the next 25 years of growth for our regional economy.
And as Dr. Emsley said earlier, you know, when you look at all the states that surround Kentucky, every one of them has a Research 2 institution. And as we've been told many times by legislators, we don't like being the center of the donut. I'm like, good, we don't either, you know. So there is a lots of talk about what the future of higher education looks like. So to give you these two other ones, they kind of piggyback on there. House Bill 630 did pass unanimously out of the House yesterday, and so it should have been received in the Senate today. If not today, it'll be Monday. And so not real sure exactly what's going to happen once it gets over there, because there are several pieces of legislation that pertain to this specific statute that are being discussed right now. So we'll kind of see where those conversations go. But so Senate Bill 201 is very similar to House Bill 630, except that where House Bill 630 is specific just to WKU, Senate Bill 201 would create a, well, CPE would have to promulgate the regs to create specific criteria that any comprehensive university would have to meet to be able to offer PhD programs. So it's slightly different in the fact that we don't know exactly what that criteria fully would look like. But that one, I only bring this up because the president testified on that one as well. That was heard in the Senate Education Committee for discussion only. So there was no vote taken on that bill.
Can I jump in?
Yes,
because
please.
I think that, so it's important to recognize what the concerns are potentially around PhD programs. And so in all of our conversations with legislators, but also with broader policymakers and folks in CPE and our colleagues at Louisville and Kentucky, if you're offering a PhD program, it must be of the highest quality and caliber. And you also must have the research infrastructure set up to take advantage of and build that program. And so one of the things that I've had direct conversations with President Thompson of CPE is they want to ensure that any institution that's has the capacity to do this meets certain criteria. And one of the ones that was really important to Aaron was, you know, we want WKU, before this happens, is to be able to have a 60% graduation rate. So do we. Louisville's at 62, Kentucky's at 62, we're going to be at 60, we're going to be there in the next couple of years, as I look to the President Morehead State calling me, because he wants to offer a PhD in something, I'm sure. But we have to be able to demonstrate that we are prepared. And if someone else wants to offer a PhD, that's not my problem. That's on them to demonstrate that they are prepared or can get over the high bar that should exist for a PhD program.
So the last piece to these two bills is Senate Joint Resolution 170. And so a joint resolution and a concurrent resolution still both have to go through the legislative process of committee hearings and passage on the floor and those types of things. The Senate Joint Resolution says that CPE shall meet with all of the university presidents of the comprehensive universities to talk about what is your priority program beyond for past baccalaureate initiatives. So as you see, this kind of ties back to both of these pieces of legislation, and that we have to be able to talk about how it addresses a workforce or an economic need in the state. Then CPE will be required to do a study. And they will look at what are these initiatives that all of these comprehensive universities want to provide. And it will be, okay, well, one, does Kentucky need this? Two, okay, say Kentucky needs this. Where's the best place for it to be located? Those types of questions. And then also they will be looking at the comprehensive universities and whether or not we are all meeting the performance funding metrics and all of these different things that they have in place that's telling us this is what you should be doing as a comprehensive university. Are you meeting this? Before decisions are made, because a lot of these, not these programs specifically that we've been discussing, but some of the other pieces of legislation that are out there are very large investments, financial investments by the state. And so I think this is there to look at, is this the best use of taxpayer dollars? Is this what we need to be doing as a state? And looking at it kind of much more holistically. So Senate Joint Resolution has been referred to the Senate Education Committee, and we're just waiting for further action on that. So those are the big ones. Do you all have any questions? Any questions on President Bonnie's comments?
You're busy.
Well, I think, again, this speaks to the collaboration not only within the university, in our different colleges, but with the city and county. And I would refer people, if you haven't read Knowledge Towns, that book, it's what we're doing. And we have such an opportunity here in South Central Kentucky, up and down I-65 from Nashville to Louisville. And John Mark's right, they're coming, more people are coming, and we're positioned to take advantage of that. But building that infrastructure, which we've been doing, should position us well.
And to your point, I have had many of my colleagues at the other universities, other comprehensives, reach out to me and say, what's the secret down there? What are you all doing? Can we come and learn? And I've actually put together full day, 2 day meetings for one university in particular to come and meet with our community leaders and learn about what we're doing down here. So, I mean, they see what we're doing, and everybody wants it too.
Now, I will tell you that university went back home and tried to start a conversation with their county and it, or city commission, and it completely imploded because it's us them instead of just us. And, you know, 25 years ago, Judge Buchanan had the idea for the Transpark, and people thought that was nuts at the time. Why do you need almost 2,000 acres of land set aside? Well, 25 years later, that has driven our regional economy in such a way that we are the fastest growing city in the Commonwealth, and will be the third largest county behind Jefferson and Fayette, Louisville, in the next several years. And so I believe, and I think I know my colleagues in the city and the county and the chamber also believe, that the Innovation Campus is Transpark 2.0. That's the next 25 years of growth for our region. And so we're working together to make sure that we're positioned to take advantage of that. And PhD is part of that. The companies relocating are part of that. Investment in the Innovation Campus is part of that. And it's all integrated. So it's a really exciting time.
That's all I have.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer. Does anybody have any other business?
Madam Chair, just to revisit something from earlier, not to bring anything back up, but I didn't have any questions about the NCAA audit, but there's a lot of questions have come out about some of the numbers in there and some interpretations of those, and so I just thought we could ask about a question or two about some of these numbers, just to clarify a few things. So first question being,
stand next to my fellow AD, if that's okay.
Apparently, he went from to Auburn.
Yeah, we all make mistakes.
Well, yeah. one of the things we saw in here is a statement of revenues and expenses that talked about $40 million. What is your actual budget? Does it seem like that's what that is?
No, it's not close to that. In terms of the annual operating budget, my sense is that $40 million must be derived from endowments, debt service, maybe it was money that went to the soccer softball facility. I'm not sure, but our annual spending is in the $28 to $30 million range.
Something else that I've been hit with, just as questions from the community, it showed a revenue for the bowl game of like $13,000 and expenses of $500 and something along those lines. How do we come out on the bowl game? Is that something we make money on, or?
Yeah, so if those were the only numbers that applied, then that would show $487,000 loss on the bowl game. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's not even close. We made money off the bowl game. We didn't lose money off the bowl game. And the reason we make money off the bowl game is what that didn't point out is the conference pays the vast majority of our bowl expenses. So in terms of our cost to go to the site and our cost at the site, Conference USA, along with all the other schools that make a bowl game, they reimburse you. So you're made whole. But we actually make money from going to a bowl game because separate from that, there's the college football playoff distribution that goes to each conference. And the way Conference USA does that is that there's a stipend that goes to the schools that make a bowl game that's more than those who don't. So we make money off the bowl game. We don't lose money off of it.
Yeah.
It was a misleading number that I saw as well. Because, you know, that we present, you and I are the two people that have audits that are presented in front of the board that are separate from the university. Yours, though, is a procedural audit related to the NCAA. Mine's a little more formal related to grants and things that we receive. I don't think that it was... It confuses me that the numbers were so far grossly misrepresented to the $40 million total based on what you actually spent. And I hope that somewhere that will get clarified. Is there anything that anybody can do to really demonstrate the real number? I mean, that's the thing is, when we talk about facilities and debt service and those things, those are things that get lumped in to university expenses all the time. The force of this audit and the way that it has to be presented is what creates some of those numbers, like the total university debt. These are not numbers that are discussed in a regular audit, right? But they're comparative statistics for benchmarking, right, for the NCAA. And I think when you see misleading numbers like $10 for rights, and I wish there was a way for greater clarity just for people that interpret those as maybe that's a bad deal, when in reality that's the way this particular type of audit has to be presented.
Right. And I mean, what I would say is, I mean, there's sticker shock when you see some of these numbers. I would have sticker shock. But, you know, the university, yes, they subsidize our athletic department. Like, you subsidize a lot of things. And, you know, our $30 million, which is a high-end estimate, but, you know, we're probably in the 28 to 30 in terms of what we spend. This year alone, I mean, of that 30, we actually have self-generated over $12 million in revenue. That's an all-time high for athletics. So we are growing the revenues that we control and will continue to do so. So I mean, even of the 30, that 12 of that's us. Yes, we are subsidized, but, you know, along with other people. But I would say it's money well spent. I'm biased. I'm the athletic director. But, I mean, I would say it's money well spent from this standpoint. I swear to you this would be the truth. If the university hired an athletics consultant to come in and to tear everything open and look at every cent that's spent, they would conclude, I guarantee you, they would conclude that our budget, in comparison to our peers, when you look at that and you look at the success that we have on the field of play, the success we have in the classroom, the graduates that we're turning out that represent this university extremely well after they leave here, the vibe we bring to campus, nothing brings students together more than an athletics program does. The people we bring to campus that wouldn't otherwise come here if we didn't have athletic events, and then the millions of dollars of exposure that athletics, a good, successful athletics program brings a university, you would conclude that it's a successful, efficient operation. I'm enormously confident that would be the conclusion. Philosophically, we can always debate on where money is spent and is it smart and is it not, and I totally understand that and I totally get that. That's a great thing about our country. We can agree on things, we can agree to disagree on things.
Todd, I'm gonna jump in here because I do think, look, this is a perennial question on every university campus I've been on. Athletics versus, and it doesn't need to be athletics versus. We do lots of things here, and we invest in a wide range of experiences and activities for our students. We invest a lot more in forensics and speech and debate on this campus than any other campus I've been on. Why? Because we want to have the best speech and debate team in the country. What's the return on that? Winning national championships. We have a remarkable student publication staff, right? And we subsidize them, whether they believe it or not. Those salaries that are paid for those staff, those are university dollars that we believe in, right? And that's why we put those dollars into that budget. We've got a remarkable esports team, right? Starting to win national competitions. Why? Because we want to compete at a national level there. And our athletics program, if you look at our clip sheet, that's the media mentions we have, 90% of the media mentions for WKU are completely derived from athletics competitions and winning. And then I'm going to say this. Our athletics programs graduate students, including our football program, at a higher rate than the average undergraduate student. These are remarkable students, and we want to recruit them and have them as part of our community. We decided we were going to do Division I athletics. We didn't kill football 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Guess what, folks? If we're going to do it, we are going to do it right. The same way we do academics right. We can do all of it because that's the kind of institution we are. So this us versus them stuff, this disinvestment stuff, just stop it. I'm not talking to the people in this room. The people who need to hear it are probably listening. I want them to hear that from me. I'm just tired of it.
Amanda's with us. Every donor event that I've been to, it's remarkable when they actually you list what people have given, and the people that are giving to athletics are giving considerably more to academics in terms of the donations for various things.
Absolutely. Most of them give to multiple areas across the university, including athletics.
Yeah. I've found that remarkable at every one of those events I've been to.
I want to finish with this. It's not us versus them. It's all us. It's all WKU. Every bit of it. And so we should be proud of all of it. If you don't want to go to a sports game, that's okay. That's okay. Go see a musical event. But it's all us. And it's what makes this place special.
Real quick, is there any area of this campus that isn't subsidized?
No.
Well, because I know your public media group is subsidized as well, and we're successful, and we appreciate that. But I also wanted to give some clarity that every area of this campus has a subsidy. And I think if we try to inflate that or misstate that or augment that is a bad thing. I think it's a disservice to every group on this campus that does not generate any revenue that lives with a high subsidy. This area generates revenue, generates academic success, as we've already touted. I mean, there are very few, and I'll refer to the 10-year strategic plan. There are no lines on that plan but athletics that began at the successful standard that they needed to end with because of the high percentage of graduation success and the that one score, the 930, that is a very difficult score to reach that you continue to reach.
The APR.
The APR, which is, if people haven't studied why that's important, man, you'd find me a school that can do that every single year. And I will echo that Todd does more for less than any athletics program that I have seen in all of the time that I've been in the side of the business that I've been in. That includes 11 years with ESPN. So I just wanted to throw that out there as well. Thanks for answering the question.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Todd. I appreciate that clarification. Do we have a motion going to close session?
I do. I want to make a motion that the board go into closed session and provide it in ARS 61.810 following discussion. Discussion of proposed or pending litigation against or on behalf of the university.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the board is now returned to open session. The discussions and deliberations during the closed session were restricted to those stated in the motion, and no formal action was taken by the board in closed session. Okay. And do we need a motion to adjourn?
I'll make that motion.
Second.
All in favor?
I was going to adjourn.
All right, Linda can have my second.
No. Thank you, Carl.